Fancy, the three princesses have received very little, Prince Vasily nothing, and it is Monsieur Pierre who has inherited all the property and has besides been recognized as legitimate, so that he is now Count Bezukhov and possessor of the finest fortune in Russia. It is rumored that Prince Vasily played a very despicable part in this affair, and that he returned to Petersburg quite crestfallen. I confess I understand very little about all these matters of wills and inheritance, but I do know that since this young man, whom we all used to know as plain Monsieur Pierre, has become Count Bezukhov and the owner of one of the largest fortunes in Russia, I am much amused to watch the change in the tone and manners of the mamas burdened by marriageable daughters, and of the young ladies themselves towards him, though between you and me he always seemed to me a poor sort of fellow. As for the past 2 years, people have amused themselves by finding husbands for me, most of whom I don't even know. The matchmaking chronicles of Moscow now speak of me as the future Countess Bezukhova, but you will understand that I have no desire for the post. Apropos of marriages, do you know that a while ago that universal auntie Anna Mikhailovna told me, under the seal of strict secrecy, of a plan of marriage for you? It is neither more nor less than with Prince Vasily's son Anatole, whom they wish to reform by marrying him to someone rich and distingué, and it is on you that his relations' choice has fallen. I don't know what you will think of it, but I consider it my duty to let you know of it. He is said to be very handsome and a terrible scapegrace. That is all I've been able to find out about him. But enough of gossip. I'm at the end of my second sheet of paper, and Mama has sent for me to go and dine at the Apraksins'. Read the mystical book I'm sending you. It has an enormous success here. Though there are things in it difficult for the feeble human mind to grasp, it is an admirable book which calms and elevates the soul. Adieu. Give my respects to Monsieur your father, and my compliments to Mademoiselle Bourienne. I embrace you as I love you. Julie. P.S. Let me have news of your brother and his charming little wife. Princess Mary pondered a while with a thoughtful smile, and her luminous eyes lit up so that her face was entirely transformed. Then she suddenly rose, and with a heavy tread went up to the table. She took a sheet of paper, and her hand moved rapidly over it. This is the reply she wrote, also in French. Dear and precious friend, your letter of the 13th has given me great delight. So you still love me, my romantic Julie. Separation, of which you say so much that is bad, does not seem to have had its usual effect on you. You complain of our separation. What then should I say if I dared complain, I who am deprived of all who are dear to me? Ah, if we had not religion to console us, life would be very sad. Why do you suppose that I should look severely on your affection for that young man? On such matters I am only severe with myself. I understand such feelings in others, and if never having felt them I cannot approve of them, neither do I condemn them. Only it seems to me that Christian love, love of one's neighbor, love of one's enemy, is worthier, sweeter, and better than the feelings which the beautiful eyes of a young man can inspire in a romantic and loving young girl like yourself. The news of Count Bezukhov's death reached us before your letter, and my father was much affected by it. He says the Count was the last representative but one of the great century, and that it is his own turn now, but that he will do all he can to let his turn come as late as possible. God preserve us from that terrible misfortune. I cannot agree with you about Pierre, whom I knew as a child. He always seemed to me to have an excellent heart, and that is the quality I value most in people. As to his inheritance and the part played by Prince Vasily, it is very sad for both. Ah, my dear friend, our divine Saviour's words, that it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, are terribly true. I pity Prince Vasily, but am still more sorry for Pierre. So young, and burdened with such riches, to what temptations he will be exposed. If I were asked what I desire most on earth, it would be to be poorer than the poorest beggar. 1,000 thanks, dear friend, for the volume you have sent me, and which has such success in Moscow. Yet, since you tell me that among some good things it contains others which our weak human understanding cannot grasp, It seems to me rather useless to spend time in reading what is unintelligible and can therefore bear no fruit. I never could understand the fondness some people have for confusing their minds by dwelling on mystical books that merely awaken their doubts and excite their imagination, giving them a bent for exaggeration quite contrary to Christian simplicity. Let us rather read the epistles and gospels. Let us not seek to penetrate what mysteries they contain, for how can we, miserable sinners that we are, know the terrible and holy secrets of providence while we remain in this flesh, which forms an impenetrable veil between us and the eternal? Let us rather confine ourselves to studying those sublime rules which our divine Savior has left for our guidance here below. Let us try to conform to them and follow them, and let us be persuaded that the less we let our feeble human minds roam, the better we shall please God, who rejects all knowledge that does not come from Him. And the less we seek to fathom what He has been pleased to conceal from us, the sooner will He vouchsafe its revelation to us through His divine Spirit. My father has not spoken to me of a suitor, but has only told me that he has received a letter and is expecting a visit from Prince Vasily. In regard to this project of marriage for me, I will tell you, dear sweet friend, that I look on marriage as a divine institution to which we must conform. However painful it may be to me, should the Almighty ever lay the duties of wife and mother upon me, I shall try to perform them as faithfully as I can, without disquieting myself by examining my feelings toward him whom he may choose to give me for a husband. I have had a letter from my brother, who announces his speedy arrival at Bald Hills with his wife. This pleasure will be a brief one, however, for he will leave us again to take part in this unhappy war into which we have been drawn. God knows how or why. Not only where you are, at the heart of affairs and of the world, is the talk all of war. Even here, amid field work and the calm of nature, which townsfolk consider characteristic of the country, rumors of war are heard and painfully felt. My father talks of nothing but marches and countermarches, things of which I understand nothing. And the day before yesterday, during my daily walk through the village, I witnessed a heart-rending scene. It was a convoy of conscripts enrolled from our people and starting to join the army. You should have seen the state of the mothers, wives, and children of the men who were going, and should have heard the sobs. It seems as though mankind has forgotten the laws of its divine Savior, who preached love and forgiveness of injuries, and that men attribute the greatest merit to skill in killing one another. Adieu, dear and kind friend. May our divine Savior and his most holy mother keep you in their holy and all-powerful care. Mary.
Ah, you are sending off a letter, Princess. I have already dispatched mine. I have written to my poor mother, said the smiling Mademoiselle Bourienne, rapidly in her pleasant, mellow tones and with guttural R's. She brought into Princess Mary's strenuous, mournful, and gloomy world a quite different atmosphere, careless, light-hearted, and self-satisfied. Princess, I must warn you, she added, lowering her voice and evidently listening to herself with pleasure and speaking with exaggerated grassement, the guttural pronunciation of the letter R chiefly affected by Parisians. The prince has been scolding Michael Ivanovich. He is in a very bad humor, very morose. Be prepared. Ah, dear friend, replied Princess Mary, I've asked you never to warn me of the humor my father is in. I do not allow myself to judge him, and would not have others do so. The princess glanced at her watch, and seeing that she was 5 minutes late in starting her practice on the clavichord, went into the sitting room with a look of alarm. Between 12 and 2 o'clock, as the day was mapped out, the prince rested, and the princess played the clavichord. Chapter 15. Prince Andrew at Bald Hills. The gray-haired valet was sitting drowsily listening to the snoring of the prince, who was in his large study. From the far side of the house, through the closed doors, came the sound of difficult passages, 20 times repeated, of a sonata by Dussek.
Just then, a closed carriage and another with a hood drove up to the porch. Prince Andrew got out of the carriage, helped his little wife to alight, and let her pass into the house before him. Old Tichon, wearing a wig, put his head out of the door of the antechamber, reported in a whisper that the prince was sleeping, and hastily closed the door. Tichon knew that neither the son's arrival nor any other unusual event must be allowed to disturb the appointed order of the day. Prince Andrew apparently knew this as well as Tichon. He looked at his watch as if to ascertain whether father's habits had changed since he was at home last, and having assured himself that they had not, he turned to his wife. "He will get up in 20 minutes. Let us go across to Mary's room," he said. The little princess had grown stouter during this time, but her eyes and her short, downy, smiling lip lifted when she began to speak just as merrily and prettily as ever. "Why, this is a palace," she said to her husband, looking around with the expression with which people compliment their host at a ball. "Let's come, quick, quick." And with a glance round, she smiled at Tichon, at her husband, and at the footman who accompanied them. "Is that Mary practicing? Let's go quietly and take her by surprise." Prince Andrew followed her with a courteous but sad expression. "You've grown older, Tichon," he said in passing to the old man, who kissed his hand. Before they reached the room from which the sounds of the clavichord came, the pretty, fair-haired Frenchwoman, Mademoiselle Bourienne, rushed out, apparently beside herself with delight. "Ah, what joy for the princess!" exclaimed she. "At last I must let her know." "No, no, please not. You're Mademoiselle Bourienne," said the little princess, kissing her. "I know you already through my sister-in-law's friendship for you. She was not expecting us." They went up to the door of the sitting-room, from which came the sound of the oft-repeated passage of the sonata. Prince Andrew stopped and made a grimace as if expecting something unpleasant. The little princess entered the room. The passage broke off in the middle, a cry was heard, then Princess Mary's heavy tread and the sound of kissing. When Prince Andrew went in, the two princesses, who had only met once before for a short time at his wedding, were in each other's arms, warmly pressing their lips to whatever place they happened to touch. Mademoiselle Bourienne stood near them, pressing her hand to her heart with a beatific smile, and obviously equally ready to cry or to laugh. Prince Andrew shrugged his shoulders and frowned, as lovers of music do when they hear a false note. The two women let go of one another, and then, as if afraid of being too late, seized each other's hands, kissing them and pulling them away, and again began kissing each other on the face. And then, to Prince Andrew's surprise, both began to cry and kissed again. Mademoiselle Bourienne also began to cry. Prince Andrew evidently felt ill at ease, but to the two women it seemed quite natural that they should cry, and apparently it never entered their heads that it could have been otherwise at this meeting. "Ah, my dear, ah, Mary," they suddenly exclaimed, and then laughed. "I dreamed last night. You were not expecting us? Ah, Mary, you've got thinner, and you've grown stouter." "I knew the princess at once," put in Mademoiselle Bourienne. "And I had no idea," exclaimed Princess Mary. "Ah, Andrew, I did not see you." Prince Andrew and his sister, hand in hand, kissed one another, and he told her she was still the same crybaby as ever. Princess Mary had turned toward her brother, and through her tears, the loving, warm, gentle look of her large, luminous eyes, very beautiful at that moment, rested on Prince Andrew's face. The little princess talked incessantly, her short, downy upper lip continually and rapidly touching her rosy nether lip when necessary, and drawing up again next moment when her face broke into a smile of glittering teeth and sparkling eyes. She told of an accident they had had on the Spassky Hill, which might have been serious for her in her condition, and immediately after that informed them that she had left all her clothes in Petersburg, and that heaven knew what she would have to dress in here, and that Andrew had quite changed, and that Kitty Odintseva had married an old man, and that there was a suitor for Mary, a real one, but that they would talk of that later. Princess Mary was still looking silently at her brother, and her beautiful eyes were full of love and sadness. It was plain that she was following a train of thought independent of her sister-in-law's words. In the midst of a description of the last Petersburg fete, she addressed her brother. "So you are really going to the war, Andrew?" she said, sighing. Lise sighed, too. "Yes, and even tomorrow," replied her brother. "He is leaving me here, God knows why, when he might have had promotion. Princess Mary did not listen to the end, but continuing her train of thought, turned to her sister-in-law with a tender glance at her figure. "Is it certain?" she said. The face of the little princess changed. She sighed and said, "Yes, quite certain. Ah, it is very dreadful." Her lip descended. She brought her face close to her sister-in-law's and unexpectedly again began to cry. "She needs rest," said Prince Andrew with a frown. "Don't you, Lise? Take her to your room and I'll go to father. How is he? Just the same?" "Yes, just the same, though I don't know what your opinion will be," answered the princess joyfully. "And are the hours the same, and the walks in the avenues, and the lathe?" asked Prince Andrew, with a scarcely perceptible smile, which showed that, in spite of all his love and respect for his father, he was aware of his weaknesses. "The hours are the same, and the lathe, and also the mathematics and my geometry lessons," said Princess Mary gleefully, as if her lessons in geometry were among the greatest delights of her life. When the 20 minutes had elapsed, and the time had come for the old prince to get up, Tichon came to call the young prince to his father. The old man made a departure from his usual routine in honor of his son's arrival. He gave orders to admit him to his apartments while he dressed for dinner. The old prince always dressed in old-fashioned style, wearing an antique coat and powdered hair. And when Prince Andrew entered his father's dressing room, not with the contemptuous look and manner he wore in drawing rooms, but with the animated face with which he talked to Pierre, the old man was sitting on a large leather-covered chair, wrapped in a powdering mantle, and trusting his head to Tichon.
"Ah, here's the warrior. Wants to vanquish Bonaparte?" said the old man, shaking his powdered head as much as the tail which Tichon was holding fast to plait allowed him. "You at least must tackle him properly, or else if he goes on like this, he'll soon have us too for his subjects. How are you?"
And he held out his cheek. The old man was in a good temper after his nap before dinner. He used to say that a nap after dinner was silver, before dinner golden. He cast happy sidelong glances at his son from under his thick, bushy eyebrows. Prince Andrew went up and kissed his father on the spot indicated to him. He made no reply on his father's favorite topic, making fun of the military men of the day, and more particularly of Bonaparte. "Yes, father, I have come to you and brought my wife, who is pregnant," said Prince Andrew, following every movement of his father's face with an eager and respectful look. "How's your health?"
"Only fools and rakes fall ill, my boy. You know me. I'm busy from morning till night, and abstemious, so of course I'm well."
"Thank God," said his son, smiling.
"God has nothing to do with it. Well, go on," he continued, returning to his hobby. "Tell me how the Germans have taught you to fight Buonaparte by this new science you call strategy."
Prince Andrew smiled. "Give me time to collect my wits, father," said he, with a smile that showed that his father's foibles did not prevent his son from loving and honoring him. "Why, I've not yet had time to settle down."
"Nonsense, nonsense,"
cried the old man, shaking his pigtail to see whether it was firmly plaited, and grasping his son by the hand. "The house for your wife is ready. Princess Mary will take her there and show her over, and they'll talk 19 to the dozen. That's their women's way.
I'm glad to have her. Sit down and talk. About Michelson's army, I understand. Tolstoy's, too. A simultaneous expedition. But what's the southern army to do, Prussia is neutral. I know that. What about Austria?"
said he, rising from his chair and pacing up and down the room, followed by Tichon, who ran after him, handing him different articles of clothing.
"What of Sweden? How will they cross Pomerania?"
Prince Andrew, seeing that his father insisted, began, at first reluctantly, but gradually with more and more animation, and from habit changing unconsciously from Russian to French as he went on, to explain the plan of operation for the coming campaign. He explained how an army 90,000 strong was to threaten Prussia so as to bring her out of her neutrality and draw her into the war. How part of that army was to join some Swedish forces at Stralsund, how 220,000 Austrians with 100,000 Russians were to operate in Italy and on the Rhine, how 50,000 Russians and as many English were to land at Naples, and how a total force of 500,000 men was to attack the French from different sides. The old prince did not evince the least interest during this explanation, but as if he were not listening to it, continued to dress while walking about, and three times unexpectedly interrupted. Once he stopped it by shouting, "The White One! The White One!" This meant that Tijuan was not handing him the waistcoat he wanted. Another time he interrupted, saying, "And will she soon be confined?" And shaking his head reproachfully, said, "That's bad. Go on, go on." The third interruption came when Prince Andrew was finishing his description. The old man began to sing in the cracked voice of old age, "Malbrook s'en va tant gai heureux, Dieu sait quand reviendra." Marlborough is going to the wars. God knows when he'll return. His son only smiled. "I don't say it's a plan I approve of," said the son. "I'm only telling you what it is. Napoleon has also formed his plan by now, not worse than this one." "Well, you've told me nothing new." And the old man repeated, meditatively and rapidly, "Dieu sait quand reviendra." "Go to the dining room." At the appointed hour, the prince, powdered and shaven, entered the dining room, where his daughter-in-law, Princess Mary, and Mademoiselle Bourienne were already awaiting him, together with his architect, who, by a strange caprice of his employer's, was admitted to table, though the position of that insignificant individual was such as could certainly not have caused him to expect that honor. The prince, who generally kept very strictly to social distinctions and rarely admitted even important government officials to his table, had unexpectedly selected Michael Ivanovich, who always went into a corner to blow his nose on his checked handkerchief, to illustrate the theory that all men are equals, and had more than once impressed on his daughter that Michael Ivanovich was not a whit worse than you or I. At dinner, the prince usually spoke to the taciturn Michael Ivanovich more often than to anyone else. In the dining room, which, like all the rooms in the house, was exceedingly lofty, the members of the household and the footman, one behind each chair, stood waiting for the prince to enter. The head butler, napkin on arm, was scanning the setting of the table, making signs to the footman, and anxiously glancing from the clock to the door by which the prince was to enter. Prince Andrew was looking at a large gilt frame, new to him, containing the genealogical tree of the princes Bolkonski, opposite which hung another such frame, with a badly painted portrait, evidently by the hand of the artist belonging to the estate, of a ruling prince in a crown, an alleged descendant of Rurik and ancestor of the Bolkonskis. Prince Andrew, looking again at that genealogical tree, shook his head, laughing as a man laughs who looks at a portrait so characteristic of the original as to be amusing. "How thoroughly like him that is," he said to Princess Mary, who had come up to him. Princess Mary looked at her brother in surprise. She did not understand what he was laughing at. Everything her father did inspired her with reverence and was beyond question. "Everyone has his Achilles heel," continued Prince Andrew. "Fancy, with his powerful mind, indulging in such nonsense." Princess Mary could not understand the boldness of her brother's criticism and was about to reply when the expected footsteps were heard coming from the study. The prince walked in quickly and jauntily, as was his wont, as if intentionally contrasting the briskness of his manners with the strict formality of his house. At that moment the great clock struck two, and another with a shrill tone joined in from the drawing-room. The prince stood still. His lively glittering eyes from under their thick bushy eyebrows sternly scanned all present and rested on the little princess. She felt, as courtiers do when the Tsar enters, the sensation of fear and respect which the old man inspired in all around him. He stroked her hair and then patted her awkwardly on the back of her neck. "I'm glad to see you," he said, looking attentively into her eyes, and then quickly went to his place and sat down.
Sit down, Michael Ivanovich."
He indicated a place beside him to his daughter-in-law. A footman moved the chair for her.
"Oh-ho," said the old man, casting his eyes on her rounded figure. "You've been in a hurry. That's bad."
He laughed in his usual dry, cold, unpleasant way, with his lips only and not with his eyes.
"You must walk as much as possible, as much as possible," he said.
The little princess did not wish to hear his words. She was silent and seemed confused. The prince asked her about her father, and she began to smile and talk. He asked about mutual acquaintances, and she became still more animated, and chattered away, giving him greetings from various people, and retailing the town gossip.
"Countess Apraxina, poor thing, has lost her husband,
and she has cried her eyes out," she said, growing more and more lively. As she became animated, the prince looked at her more and more sternly, and suddenly, as if he had studied her sufficiently and had formed a definite idea of her, he turned away and addressed Michael Ivanovitch. "Well, Michael Ivanovitch, our Buonaparte will be having a bad time of it. Prince Andrew," he always spoke thus of his son, "has been telling me what forces are being collected against him, while you and I never thought much of him." Michael Ivanovitch did not at all know when "you and I" had said such things about Bonaparte, but understanding that he was wanted as a peg on which to hang the prince's favorite topic, he looked inquiringly at the young prince, wondering what would follow. "He's a great tactician," said the prince to his son, pointing to the architect. And the conversation again turned on the war, on Bonaparte and the generals and statesmen of the day. The old prince seemed convinced not only that all the men of the day were mere babies who did not know the ABC of war or of politics, and that Bonaparte was an insignificant little Frenchy, successful only because there were no longer any Potemkins or Suvorovs left to oppose him, but he was also convinced that there were no political difficulties in Europe and no real war, but only a sort of puppet show at which the men of the day were playing, pretending to do something real. Prince Andrew gaily bore with his father's ridicule of the new men and drew him on and listened to him with evident pleasure. "The past always seems good," said he. "But did not Suvorov himself fall into a trap Moreau set him, and from which he did not know how to escape?"
"Who told you that? Who?" cried the prince. "Suvorov?"
And he jerked away his plate, which Tikhon briskly caught.
"Suvorov? Consider, Prince Andrew. Two, Frederick and Suvorov. Moreau would have been a prisoner if Suvorov had had a free hand. But he had the Hofskriegsfürst Schnapsrat on his hands."
Court War Sausage Schnaps Council, Prince Bolkonski's contemptuous name for the Austrian Council of War.
"It would have puzzled the devil himself. When you get there, you'll find out what those Hofskriegswurstrats are. Suvorov couldn't manage them, so what chance has Michael Kutuzov?
Now, my dear boy," he continued, "you and your generals won't get on against Buonaparte. You'll have to call in the French so that birds of a feather may fight together. The German, Pahlen, has been sent to New York in America to fetch the Frenchman Moreau," he said, alluding to the invitation made that year to Moreau to enter the Russian service.
"Wonderful. Were the Potemkins, Suvorovs, and Orlovs Germans? No, lad. Either you fellows have all lost your wits or I have outlived mine. May God help you, but we'll see what will happen. Buonaparte has become a great commander among them."
"I don't at all say that all the plans are good," said Prince Andrew. "I'm only surprised at your opinion of Bonaparte. You may laugh as much as you like, but all the same, Bonaparte is a great general."
"Michael Ivanovitch," cried the old prince to the architect,
who, busy with his roast meat, hoped he had been forgotten.
"Didn't I tell you Buonaparte was a great tactician? Here, he says the same thing."
"To be sure, Your Excellency," replied the architect.
The prince again laughed his frigid laugh.
"Buonaparte was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He has got splendid soldiers. Besides, he began by attacking Germans, and only idlers have failed to beat the Germans. Since the world began, everybody has beaten the Germans. They beat no one except one another. He made his reputation fighting them."
Old Prince Bolkonski began explaining all the blunders which, according to him, Bonaparte had made in his campaigns and even in politics. His son made no rejoinder, but it was evident that whatever arguments were presented, he was as little able as his father to change his opinion. He listened, refraining from a reply, and involuntarily wondered how this old man, living alone in the country for so many years, could know and discuss so minutely and acutely all the recent European military and political events.
"You think I'm an old man and don't understand the present state of affairs," concluded the father. "But it troubles me. I don't sleep at night. Come now, where has this great commander of yours shown his skill?" he concluded.
"That would take too long to tell," answered the son.
"Well, then go off to your Buonaparte. Mademoiselle Bourienne, here's another admirer of that powder monkey emperor of yours," he exclaimed in excellent French.
"You know, Prince, I am not a Bonapartist."
"Dieu sait quand reviendra,"
hummed the prince out of tune, and with a laugh still more so, he quitted the table. The little princess, during the whole discussion and the rest of the dinner, sat silent, glancing with a frightened look now at her father-in-law and now at Princess Mary. When they left the table, she took her sister-in-law's arm and drew her into another room. "What a clever man your father is," said she. "Perhaps that is why I am afraid of him." "Oh, he's so kind," answered Princess Mary. Chapter 16. Prince Andrew leaves to join the army. Princess Mary gives him an icon. Prince Andrew was to leave next evening. The old prince, not altering his routine, retired as usual after dinner. The little princess was in her sister-in-law's room. Prince Andrew, in a traveling coat without epaulets, had been packing with his valet in the rooms assigned to him. After inspecting the carriage himself and seeing the trunks put in, he ordered the horses to be harnessed. Only those things he always kept with him remained in his room: a small box, a large canteen fitted with silver plate, two Turkish pistols, and a saber, a present from his father, who had brought it from the siege of Vochakov. All these traveling effects of Prince Andrew's were in very good order, new, clean, and in cloth covers carefully tied with tapes. When starting on a journey or changing their mode of life, men capable of reflection are generally in a serious frame of mind. At such moments, one reviews the past and plans for the future. Prince Andrew's face looked very thoughtful and tender. With his hands behind him, he paced briskly from corner to corner of the room, looking straight before him and thoughtfully shaking his head. Did he fear going to the war? Or was he sad at leaving his wife? Perhaps both, but evidently he did not wish to be seen in that mood, for hearing footsteps in the passage, he hurriedly unclasped his hands, stopped at a table as if tying the covers of the small box, and assumed his usual tranquil and impenetrable expression. It was the heavy tread of Princess Mary that he heard. "I hear you've given orders to harness," she cried, panting. She'd apparently been running. "And I did so wish to have another talk with you alone. God knows how long we may again be parted. You're not angry with me for coming? You've changed so, Andrusha," she added, as if to explain such a question. She smiled as she uttered his pet name, Andrusha. It was obviously strange to her to think that this stern, handsome man should be Andrusha, the slender, mischievous boy who had been her playfellow in childhood. "And where is Lise?" he asked, answering her question only by a smile. "She was so tired that she's fallen asleep on the sofa in my room." "Oh, Andrew, what a treasure of a wife you have," said she, sitting down on the sofa facing her brother. "She's quite a child, such a dear, merry child. I've grown so fond of her." Prince Andrew was silent, but the princess noticed the ironical and contemptuous look that showed itself on his face. "One must be indulgent to little weaknesses. Who is free from them, Andrew? Don't forget that she's grown up and been educated in society, and so her position now is not a rosy one. We should enter into everyone's situation. Tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. To understand all is to forgive all. Think what it must be for her, poor thing, after what she's been used to be parted from her husband and be left alone in the country, in her condition. It's very hard." Prince Andrew smiled as he looked at his sister, as we smile at those we think we thoroughly understand. "You live in the country and don't think the life terrible?" he replied. "I? That's different. Why speak of me? I don't want any other life, and can't, for I know no other. But think, Andrew, for a young society woman to be buried in the country during the best years of her life, all alone, for Papa's always busy, and I... well, you know what poor resources I have for entertaining a woman used to the best society. There is only Mademoiselle Bourienne." "I don't like your Mademoiselle Bourienne at all," said Prince Andrew. "No? She's very nice and kind. And above all, she's much to be pitied. She has no one, no one. To tell the truth, I don't need her, and she's even in my way. You know, I always was a savage, and now I'm even more so. I like being alone. Father likes her very much. She and Michael Ivanovich are the two people to whom he's always gentle and kind, because he's been a benefactor to them both. As Sterne says, we don't love people so much for the good they have done us as for the good we have done them. Father took her when she was homeless after losing her own father. She's very good-natured, and my father likes her way of reading. She reads to him in the evenings, and reads splendidly. To be quite frank, Mary, I expect Father's character sometimes makes things trying for you, doesn't it? Prince Andrew asked suddenly. Princess Mary was first surprised, and then aghast at this question.
For me? For me? Trying for me? Said she.
He always was rather harsh. And now I should think he's getting very trying, said Prince Andrew, apparently speaking lightly of their father in order to puzzle or test his sister.
You're good in every way, Andrew, but you have a kind of intellectual pride, said the princess, following the train of her own thoughts rather than the trend of the conversation. And that's a great sin. How can one judge father? But even if one might, what feeling except veneration could such a man as my father evoke? And I'm so contented and happy with him. I only wish you were all as happy as I am.
Her brother shook his head incredulously.
The only thing that is hard for me, I will tell you the truth, Andrew, is father's way of treating religious subjects. I don't understand how a man of his immense intellect can fail to see what is as clear as day and can go so far astray. That is the only thing that makes me unhappy. But even in this, I can see lately a shade of improvement. His satire has been less bitter of late, and there was a monk he received and had a long talk with.
Ah, my dear, I'm afraid you and your monk are wasting your powder, said Prince Andrew banteringly yet tenderly.
Mon ami, I only pray and hope that God will hear me. Andrew, she said timidly after a moment's silence, I have a great favor to ask of you.
What is it, dear?
No, promise that you will not refuse. It will give you no trouble, and is nothing unworthy of you, but it will comfort me.
Promise, Andrusha, said she, putting her hand in her reticule, but not yet taking out what she was holding inside it, as if what she held were the subject of her request, and must not be shown before the request was granted. She looked timidly at her brother.
Even if it were a great deal of trouble, answered Prince Andrew, as if guessing what it was about.
Think what you please. I know you are just like father. Think as you please, but do this for my sake. Please do. Father's father, our grandfather, wore it in all his wars.
She still did not take out what she was holding in her reticule.
So you promise?
Of course. What is it?
Andrew, I bless you with this icon, and you must promise me you will never take it off. Do you promise?
If it does not weigh 100 weight and won't break my neck. To please you, said Prince Andrew.
But immediately, noticing the pained expression his joke had brought to his sister's face, he repented and added, I'm glad. Really, dear, I'm very glad.
Against your will, he will save and have mercy on you, and bring you to himself, for in him alone is truth and peace,
said she in a voice trembling with emotion, solemnly holding up in both hands before her brother a small, oval, antique, dark-faced icon of the Savior in a gold setting on a finely wrought silver chain. She crossed herself, kissed the icon, and handed it to Andrew.
Please, Andrew, for my sake.
Rays of gentle light shone from her large, timid eyes. Those eyes lit up the whole of her thin, sickly face and made it beautiful. Her brother would have taken the icon, but she stopped him. Andrew understood, crossed himself, and kissed the icon. There was a look of tenderness, for he was touched, but also a gleam of irony on his face.
Thank you, my dear.
She kissed him on the forehead and sat down again on the sofa. They were silent for a while.
As I was saying to you, Andrew, be kind and generous as you always used to be. Don't judge Lise harshly, she began. She's so sweet, so good-natured, and her position now is a very hard one.
I do not think I've complained of my wife to you, Masha, or blamed her.
Why do you say all this to me?
Red patches appeared on Princess Mary's face, and she was silent as if she felt guilty. I've said nothing to you, but you've already been talked to. And I'm sorry for that, he went on. The patches grew deeper on her forehead, neck, and cheeks. She tried to say something, but could not. Her brother had guessed right. The little princess had been crying after dinner, and had spoken of her forebodings about her confinement, and of how she dreaded it, and had complained of her fate, her father-in-law, and her husband. After crying, she had fallen asleep. Prince Andrew felt sorry for his sister. Know this, Masha. I can't reproach, have not reproached, and never shall reproach my wife with anything. And I cannot reproach myself with anything in regard to her. And that will always be so in whatever circumstances I may be placed. But if you want to know the truth, if you want to know whether I am happy, no. Is she happy? No. But why this is so, I don't know. As he said this, he rose, went to his sister, and stooping, kissed her forehead. His fine eyes lit up with a thoughtful, kindly, and unaccustomed brightness, but he was looking not at his sister, but over her head toward the darkness of the open doorway. Let us go to her. I must say goodbye. Or go and wake her, and I'll come in a moment. Petrushka, he called to his valet, come here. Take these away. Put this on the seat, and this to the right. Princess Mary rose and moved to the door, then stopped and said, Andrew, if you had faith, you would have turned to God and asked him to give you the love you do not feel, and your prayer would have been answered. Well, maybe, said Prince Andrew. Go, Masha, I'll come immediately. On the way to his sister's room, in the passage which connected one wing with the other, Prince Andrew met Mademoiselle Bourienne smiling sweetly. It was the third time that day that, with an ecstatic and artless smile, she had met him in secluded passages. Oh, I thought you were in your room, she said, for some reason blushing and dropping her eyes. Prince Andrew looked sternly at her, and an expression of anger suddenly came over his face. He said nothing to her, but looked at her forehead and hair, without looking at her eyes, with such contempt that the Frenchwoman blushed and went away without a word. When he reached his sister's room, his wife was already awake, and her merry voice, hurrying one word after another, came through the open door. She was speaking as usual in French, and as if after long restraint she wished to make up for lost time. No, but imagine the old Countess Zubova with false curls and her mouth full of false teeth, as if she were trying to cheat old age. Mary! This very sentence about Countess Zubova and this same laugh Prince Andrew had already heard from his wife in the presence of others some 5 times. He entered the room softly. The little princess, plump and rosy, was sitting in an easy chair with her work in her hands, talking incessantly, repeating Petersburg reminiscences and even phrases. Prince Andrew came up, stroked her hair, and asked if she felt rested after their journey. She answered him and continued her chatter. The coach with 6 horses was waiting at the porch. It was an autumn night, so dark that the coachman could not see the carriage pole. Servants with lanterns were bustling about in the porch. The immense house was brilliant with light shining through its lofty windows. The domestic serfs were crowding in the hall, waiting to bid goodbye to the young prince. The members of the household were all gathered in the reception hall, Michael Ivanovich, Mademoiselle Bourienne, Princess Mary, and the little princess. Prince Andrew had been called to his father's study, as the latter wished to say goodbye to him alone. All were waiting for them to come out. When Prince Andrew entered the study, the old man in his old-age spectacles and white dressing gown, in which he received no one but his son, sat at the table writing. He glanced round. Going? And he went on writing. I've come to say goodbye. Kiss me here. And he touched his cheek. Thanks, thanks. What do you thank me for? For not dilly-dallying and not hanging to a woman's apron strings. The service before everything. Thanks, thanks. And he went on writing so that his quills spluttered and squeaked. If you have anything to say, say it. These 2 things can be done together, he added. About my wife. I'm ashamed as it is to leave her on your hands.
Why talk nonsense? Say what you want.
When her confinement is due, send to Moscow for an accoucheur. Let him be here. The old prince stopped writing, and as if not understanding, fixed his stern eyes on his son.
I know that no one can help if nature does not do her work, said Prince Andrew, evidently confused. I know that out of a million cases only one goes wrong, but it is her fancy and mine. They've been telling her things. She's had a dream and is frightened.
Muttered the old prince to himself, finishing what he was writing. I'll do it. He signed with a flourish, and suddenly turning to his son, began to laugh.
It's a bad business, eh?
What is bad, father?
The wife, said the old prince, briefly and significantly.
I don't understand, said Prince Andrew.
No, it can't be helped, lad, said the prince. They're all like that. One can't unmarry. Don't be afraid. I won't tell anyone, but you know it yourself.
He seized his son by the hand with small bony fingers, shook it, looked straight into his son's face with keen eyes which seemed to see through him, and again laughed his frigid laugh. The son sighed, thus admitting that his father had understood him. The old man continued to fold and seal his letter, snatching up and throwing down the wax, the seal, and the paper with his accustomed rapidity.
What's to be done? She's pretty. I will do everything. Make your mind easy, said he in abrupt sentences while sealing his letter.
Andrew did not speak. He was both pleased and displeased that his father understood him. The old man got up and gave the letter to his son.
Listen, said he. Don't worry about your wife. What can be done shall be. Now listen. Give this letter to Michael Ilarionovich. That is, Kutuzov. I have written that he should make use of you in proper places and not keep you long as an adjutant, a bad position. Tell him I remember and like him. Write and tell me how he receives you. If he's all right, serve him. Nicholas Bolkonsky's son need not serve under anyone if he is in disfavor. Now come here.
He spoke so rapidly that he did not finish half his words, but his son was accustomed to understand him. He led him to the desk, raised the lid, drew out a drawer, and took out an exercise book filled with his bold, tall, close handwriting. I shall probably die before you, so remember these are my memoirs. Hand them to the emperor after my death. Now, here is a Lombardy bond and a letter. It is a premium for the man who writes a history of Suvorov's wars. Send it to the academy. Here are some jottings for you to read when I'm gone. You will find them useful. Andrew did not tell his father that he would no doubt live a long time yet. He felt that he must not say it. I will do it all, father, he said.
Well, now goodbye.
He gave his son his hand to kiss and embraced him.
Remember this, Prince Andrew. If they kill you, it will hurt me, your old father.
He paused unexpectedly, and then in a querulous voice suddenly shrieked,
But if I hear that you have not behaved like a son of Nicholas Bolkonsky, I shall be ashamed.
You need not have said that to me, father, said the son with a smile. The old man was silent. I also wanted to ask you, continued Prince Andrew, if I'm killed and if I have a son, do not let him be taken away from you. As I said yesterday, let him grow up with you. Please.
Not let the wife have him? Said the old man and laughed.
They stood silent, facing one another. The old man's sharp eyes were fixed straight on his son's. Something twitched in the lower part of the old prince's face.
We've said goodbye. Go!
He suddenly shouted in a loud, angry voice, opening his door.
What is it? What?
Asked both princesses when they saw for a moment at the door Prince Andrew and the figure of the old man in a white dressing gown, spectacled and wigless, shouting in an angry voice. Prince Andrew sighed and made no reply.
Well, he said, turning to his wife.
And this well sounded coldly ironic, as if he were saying, Now go through your performance.
Andrew, already? Said the little princess, turning pale and looking with dismay at her husband.
He embraced her. She screamed and fell unconscious on his shoulder. He cautiously released the shoulder she leaned on, looked into her face, and carefully placed her in an easy chair. Adieu, Mary, said he gently to his sister, taking her by the hand and kissing her. And then he left the room with rapid steps. The little princess lay in the armchair, Mademoiselle Bourienne chafing her temples. Princess Mary, supporting her sister-in-law, still looked with her beautiful eyes full of tears at the door through which Prince Andrew had gone and made the sign of the cross in his direction. From the study, like pistol shots, came the frequent sound of the old man angrily blowing his nose. Hardly had Prince Andrew gone when the study door opened quickly and the stern figure of the old man in the white dressing gown looked out. "Gone?" "That's all right," said he. And looking angrily at the unconscious little princess, he shook his head reprovingly and slammed the door. Book 2. Dates of Principal Historical Events. 1805. The dates are old style. October 11th, Kutuzov inspects regiment near Braunau. Le malheureux Mack arrives. October 23rd, the Russian army crosses the Enns. October 24th, fight at Amstetten. October 28th, the Russian army crosses the Danube. October 30th, defeats Mortier at Dürrenstein. November 4th, Napoleon writes to Murat from Schönbrunn. November 4th, Battle of Schöngraben. Chapter 1. Review near Braunau. Zhirkov and Dolokhov. In October 1805, a Russian army was occupying the villages and towns of the Archduchy of Austria. And yet other regiments, freshly arriving from Russia, were settling near the fortress of Braunau and burdening the inhabitants on whom they were quartered. Braunau was the headquarters of the commander-in-chief, Kutuzov. On October 11th, 1805, one of the infantry regiments that had just reached Braunau had halted half a mile from the town, waiting to be inspected by the commander-in-chief. Despite the un-Russian appearance of the locality and surroundings, fruit gardens, stone fences, tiled roofs, and hills in the distance, and despite the fact that the inhabitants, who gazed with curiosity at the soldiers, were not Russians, the regiment had just the appearance of any Russian regiment preparing for an inspection anywhere in the heart of Russia. On the evening of the last day's march, an order had been received that the commander-in-chief would inspect the regiment on the march. Though the words of the order were not clear to the regimental commander, and the question arose whether the troops were to be in marching order or not, it was decided at a consultation between the battalion commanders to present the regiment in parade order, on the principle that it is always better to bow too low than not bow low enough. So the soldiers, after a 20-mile march, were kept mending and cleaning all night long without closing their eyes, while the adjutants and company commanders calculated and reckoned. And by morning, the regiment, instead of the straggling, disorderly crowd it had been on its last march the day before, presented a well-ordered array of 2,000 men, each of whom knew his place and his duty, had every button and every strap in place, and shone with cleanliness. And not only externally was all in order, but had it pleased the commander-in-chief to look under the uniforms, he would have found on every man a clean shirt, and in every knapsack the appointed number of articles, all, soap and all, as the soldiers say. There was only one circumstance concerning which no one could be at ease. It was the state of the soldiers' boots. More than half the men's boots were in holes. But this defect was not due to any fault of the regimental commander, for in spite of repeated demands, boots had not been issued by the Austrian commissariat, and the regiment had marched some 700 miles. The commander of the regiment was an elderly, choleric, stout, and thick-set general with grizzled eyebrows and whiskers, and wider from chest to back than across the shoulders. He had on a brand-new uniform showing the creases where it had been folded, and thick gold epaulets which seemed to stand rather than lie down on his massive shoulders. He had the air of a man happily performing one of the most solemn duties of his life. He walked about in front of the line, and at every step pulled himself up, slightly arching his back. It was plain that the commander admired his regiment, rejoiced in it, and that his whole mind was engrossed by it. Yet his strut seemed to indicate that, besides military matters, social interests and the fair sex occupied no small part of his thoughts. "Well, Michael Mitrich, sir," he said, addressing one of the battalion commanders who smilingly pressed forward. It was plain that they both felt happy.
We had our hands full last night. However, I think the regiment is not a bad one, eh?
The battalion commander perceived the jovial irony and laughed. It would not be turned off the field even on the Tsaritsyn meadow.
What?
Asked the commander. At that moment, on the road from the town on which signalers had been posted, two men appeared on horseback. They were an aide-de-camp, followed by a Cossack. The aide-de-camp just arriving had been sent to confirm the order which had not been clearly worded the day before, namely, that the commander-in-chief wished to see the regiment just in the state in which it had been on the march, in their greatcoats and packs, and without any preparation whatever. A member of the Hofkriegsrat from Vienna had come to Kutuzov the day before with proposals and demands for him to join up with the army of the Archduke Ferdinand and Mack, and Kutuzov, not considering this junction advisable, meant, among other arguments in support of his view, to show the Austrian general the wretched state in which the troops arrived from Russia. With this object, he intended to meet the regiment, so the worse the condition it was in, the better pleased the commander-in-chief would be. Though the aide-de-camp did not know these circumstances, he nevertheless delivered the definite order that the men should be in their greatcoats and in marching order, and that the commander-in-chief would otherwise be dissatisfied. On hearing this, the regimental commander hung his head, silently shrugged his shoulders, and spread out his arms with a choleric gesture. "A fine mess we've made of it," he remarked. "There now, didn't I tell you, Michael Mitrich, that if it was said on the march, it meant in greatcoats?" said he reproachfully to the battalion commander. "Oh, my God," he added, stepping resolutely forward. "Company commanders," he shouted in a voice accustomed to command. "Sergeants major." "How soon will he be here?" he asked the aide-de-camp, with a respectful politeness evidently relating to the person he was referring to. "In an hour's time, I should say. Shall we have time to change clothes?" "I don't know, General." The regimental commander, going up to the line himself, ordered the soldiers to change into their greatcoats. The company commanders ran off to their companies. The sergeants major began bustling. The greatcoats were not in very good condition. And instantly the squares that had up to then been in regular order and silent began to sway and stretch and hum with voices. On all sides, soldiers were running to and fro, throwing up their knapsacks with a jerk of their shoulders and pulling the straps over their heads, unstrapping their overcoats and drawing the sleeves on with upraised arms. In half an hour, all was again in order. Only the squares had become gray instead of black. The regimental commander walked with his jerky steps to the front of the regiment and examined it from a distance.
"Whatever is this? This!" he shouted and stood still. "Commander of the 3rd Company! Commander of the 3rd Company wanted by the General! Commander to the General! 3rd Company to the Commander!"
The words passed along the lines, and an adjutant ran to look for the missing officer. When the eager but misrepeated words had reached their destination in a cry of "The General to the 3rd Company!" the missing officer appeared from behind his company, and, though he was a middle-aged man and not in the habit of running, trotted, awkwardly stumbling on his toes, toward the general. The captain's face showed the uneasiness of a schoolboy who was told to repeat a lesson he has not learned. Spots appeared on his nose, the redness of which was evidently due to intemperance, and his mouth twitched nervously. The general looked the captain up and down as he came up panting, slackening his pace as he approached.
"You will soon be dressing your men in petticoats." "What is this?"
shouted the regimental commander, thrusting forward his jaw and pointing at a soldier in the ranks of the 3rd Company in a great coat of bluish cloth which contrasted with the others.
"What have you been after? The commander-in-chief is expected and you leave your place, eh? I'll teach you to dress the men in fancy coats for a parade, eh?"
The commander of the company, with his eyes fixed on his superior, pressed two fingers more and more rigidly to his cap, as if in this pressure lay his only hope of salvation.
"Well, why don't you speak? Whom have you got there dressed up as a Hungarian?"
said the commander with an austere jibe.
"Your Excellency..."
"Well, Your Excellency what? Your Excellency, but what about Your Excellency? Nobody knows."
"Your Excellency, it's the officer Dolokhov who has been reduced to the ranks."
said the captain softly.
Well, has he been degraded into a field marshal or into a soldier? If a soldier, he should be dressed in regulation uniform like the others.
Your Excellency, you gave him leave yourself on the march.
Gave him leave? Leave? That's just like you young men, said the regimental commander, cooling down a little. Leave, indeed. One says a word to you and you... What?
He added with renewed irritation. I beg you to dress your men decently. And the commander, turning to look at the adjutant, directed his jerky steps down the line. He was evidently pleased at his own display of anger, and, walking up to the regiment, wished to find a further excuse for wrath. Having snapped at an officer for an unpolished badge, at another because his line was not straight, he reached the third company.
How are you standing? Where's your leg? Your leg!
Shouted the commander, with a tone of suffering in his voice, while there were still five men between him and Dolokhov with his bluish-gray uniform. Dolokhov slowly straightened his bent knee, looking straight with his clear, insolent eyes in the general's face.
Why a blue coat? Off with it! Sergeant Major, change his coat! The ras...
He did not finish. General, I must obey orders, but I am not bound to endure... Dolokhov hurriedly interrupted.
No talking in the ranks! No talking, no talking!
Not bound to endure insults, Dolokhov concluded in loud, ringing tones. The eyes of the general and the soldier met. The general became silent, angrily pulling down his tight scarf. I request you to have the goodness to change your coat, he said as he turned away.
He's coming!
Shouted the signaler at that moment. The regimental commander, flushing, ran to his horse, seized the stirrup with trembling hands, threw his body across the saddle, righted himself, drew his saber, and with a happy and resolute countenance, opening his mouth awry, prepared to shout. The regiment fluttered like a bird preening its plumage and became motionless.
Attention!
Shouted the regimental commander in a soul-shaking voice which expressed joy for himself, severity for the regiment, and welcome for the approaching chief. Along the broad country road, edged on both sides by trees, came a high, light blue Viennese caleche, a light four-wheeled carriage with a folding hood, slightly creaking on its springs and drawn by six horses at a smart trot. Behind the caleche galloped the suite and a convoy of Croats. Beside Kutuzov sat an Austrian general in a white uniform that looked strange among the Russian black ones. The caleche stopped in front of the regiment. Kutuzov and the Austrian general were talking in low voices, and Kutuzov smiled slightly as, treading heavily, he stepped down from the carriage, just as if those 2,000 men breathlessly gazing at him and the regimental commander did not exist. The word of command rang out, and again the regiment quivered as with a jingling sound it presented arms. Then, amidst a dead silence, the feeble voice of the commander-in-chief was heard. The regiment roared,
Health to your excellent excellency!
And again all became silent. At first Kutuzov stood still while the regiment moved. Then he and the general in white, accompanied by the suite, walked between the ranks. From the way the regimental commander saluted the commander-in-chief and devoured him with his eyes, drawing himself up obsequiously, and from the way he walked through the ranks behind the generals, bending forward and hardly able to restrain his jerky movements, and from the way he darted forward at every word or gesture of the commander-in-chief, it was evident that he performed his duty as a subordinate with even greater zeal than his duty as a commander. Thanks to the strictness and assiduity of its commander, the regiment, in comparison with others that had reached Braunau at the same time, was in splendid condition. There were only 217 sick and stragglers. Everything was in good order, except the boots. Kutuzov walked through the ranks, sometimes stopping to say a few friendly words to officers he had known in the Turkish War, sometimes also to the soldiers. Looking at their boots, he several times shook his head sadly, pointing them out to the Austrian general with an expression which seemed to say that he was not blaming anyone, but could not help noticing what a bad state of things it was. The regimental commander ran forward on each such occasion, fearing to miss a single word of the commander-in-chief's regarding the regiment. Behind Kutuzov, at a distance that allowed every softly spoken word to be heard, followed some 20 men of his suite. These gentlemen talked among themselves and sometimes laughed. Nearest of all to the commander-in-chief walked a handsome adjutant. This was Prince Bolkonski. Beside him was his comrade Nesvitsky, a tall staff officer, extremely stout, with a kindly, smiling, handsome face and moist eyes. Nesvitsky could hardly keep from laughter, provoked by a swarthy hussar officer who walked beside him. This hussar, with a grave face and without a smile or a change in the expression of his fixed eyes, watched the regimental commander's back and mimicked his every movement. Each time the commander started and bent forward, the hussar started and bent forward in exactly the same manner. Nesvitsky laughed and nudged the others to make them look at the wag. Kutuzov walked slowly and languidly past thousands of eyes which were starting from their sockets to watch their chief. On reaching the third company, he suddenly stopped. His suite, not having expected this, involuntarily came closer to him.
"Ah, Timochin," said he,
recognizing the red-nosed captain who had been reprimanded on account of the blue greatcoat. One would have thought it impossible for a man to stretch himself more than Timochin had done when he was reprimanded by the regimental commander. But now that the commander-in-chief addressed him, he drew himself up to such an extent that it seemed he could not have sustained it had the commander-in-chief continued to look at him. And so Kutuzov, who evidently understood his case and wished him nothing but good, quickly turned away, a scarcely perceptible smile flitting over his scarred and puffy face. "Another Ismail, comrade," said he. "A brave officer. Are you satisfied with him?" he asked the regimental commander. And the latter, unconscious that he was being reflected in the hussar officer as in a looking-glass, started, moved forward, and answered, "Highly satisfied, Your Excellency." "We all have our weaknesses," said Kutuzov, smiling and walking away from him. He used to have a predilection for Bacchus. The regimental commander was afraid he might be blamed for this and did not answer. The hussar at that moment noticed the face of the red-nosed captain and his drawn-in stomach and mimicked his expression and pose with such exactitude that Nesvitsky could not help laughing. Kutuzov turned round. The officer evidently had complete control of his face, and while Kutuzov was turning, managed to make a grimace and then assume a most serious, deferential, and innocent expression. The third company was the last, and Kutuzov pondered, apparently trying to recollect something. Prince Andrew stepped forward from among the suite and said softly in French, "You told me to remind you of the officer Dolokhov, reduced to the ranks in this regiment."
"Where is Dolokhov?" asked Kutuzov.
Dolokhov, who had already changed into a soldier's gray greatcoat, did not wait to be called. The shapely figure of the fair-haired soldier, with his clear blue eyes, stepped forward from the ranks, went up to the commander-in-chief, and presented arms.
"Have you a complaint to make?" Kutuzov asked with a slight frown.
"This is Dolokhov," said Prince Andrew.
"Ah," said Kutuzov. "I hope this will be a lesson to you. Do your duty. The Emperor is gracious, and I shan't forget you if you deserve well."
The clear blue eyes looked at the commander-in-chief just as boldly as they had looked at the regimental commander, seeming by their expression to tear open the veil of convention that separates a commander-in-chief so widely from a private. "One thing I ask of Your Excellency," Dolokhov said in his firm, ringing, deliberate voice. "I ask an opportunity to atone for my fault and prove my devotion to His Majesty the Emperor and to Russia." Kutuzov turned away. The same smile of the eyes with which he had turned from Captain Timochin again flitted over his face. He turned away with a grimace as if to say that everything Dolokhov had said to him and everything he could say had long been known to him, that he was weary of it, and it was not at all what he wanted. He turned away and went to the carriage. The regiment broke up into companies, which went to their appointed quarters near Braunau, where they hoped to receive boots and clothes and to rest after their hard marches.
"You won't bear me a grudge, Prokhor Ignatich," said the regimental commander, overtaking the third company on its way to its quarters and riding up to Captain Timochin, who was walking in front.
The regimental commander's face, now that the inspection was happily over, beamed with irrepressible delight. It's in the Emperor's service. It can't be helped. One is sometimes a bit hasty on parade. I'm the first to apologize, you know me. He was very pleased, and he held out his hand to the captain. Don't mention it, General. As if I'd be so bold, replied the captain, his nose growing redder as he gave a smile which showed where two front teeth were missing that had been knocked out by the butt-end of a gun at Ismail. And tell Mr. Dolokhov that I won't forget him. He may be quite easy. And tell me, please, I've been meaning to ask, how's he behaving himself? And in general, as far as the service goes, he's quite punctilious, Your Excellency. But his character, said Timokhin. And what about his character? Asked the regimental commander. It's different on different days, answered the captain. One day he's sensible, well-educated, and good-natured, and the next he's a wild beast. In Poland, if you please, he nearly killed a Jew. Oh, well, well, remarked the regimental commander. Still, one must have pity on a young man in misfortune. You know he has important connections. Well, then, you just... I will, Your Excellency, said Timokhin, showing by his smile that he understood his commander's wish. Well, of course, of course. The regimental commander sought out Dolokhov in the ranks, and reining in his horse, said to him, after the next affair, epaulets. Dolokhov looked round, but did not say anything, nor did the mocking smile on his lips change. Well, that's all right, continued the regimental commander. A cup of vodka for the men from me, he added, so that the soldiers could hear. I thank you all. God be praised. And he rode past that company and overtook the next one. Well, he's really a good fellow. One can serve under him, said Timokhin to the subaltern beside him. In a word, a hearty one, said the subaltern, laughing. The regimental commander was nicknamed King of Hearts. The cheerful mood of their officers after the inspection infected the soldiers. The company marched on gaily. The soldiers' voices could be heard on every side. And they said Kutuzov was blind of one eye? And so he is, quite blind. No, friend, he's sharper-eyed than you are. Boots and leg bands, he noticed everything.